growth requires more than capital.
Why do we call it the cheat code? Nobody said growth had to be fair.
Revenue solves everything.
Welcome to the cheat code. What was our fastest path to revenue?
We tend to like to do things the hard way.
What's the cheat code? It's giving yourself an unfair advantage over the others.
What is it that really works, and how are we going to grow these organizations?
That's our cheat code. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Go-to-Market Cheat Code. Today, I am joined with my partner, Justin Gray. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello.
You did the last one with Sean, so you're good to have me back, or are you feeling like Sean's a better co-host?
I really miss Sean at this point.
Yeah, exactly. That checks out. Well, we're super excited. As you know, season two is focused on go-to-market partnerships, and today we are joined by a sales fanatic turned entrepreneur who was bitten by the startup bug long ago, was recognized as a top voice by LinkedIn. She's helping startups hire executive sales and CS leaders without the cringe. She's also an advisor to multiple startup founders, an LP at Stage 2 Capital, and the CEO of Avenue Talent Partners. Amy Volas, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. That's a laundry list of things that gives me...
It's quite the intro.
Vibes.
You did all that stuff.
Quite. I did it. I am still doing it, and slap on a book to boot that I am finishing. And you know what? What can she not do?
What's the book topic?
The book topic is all of the most common hiring pitfalls for founders, why they occur, what they
How long is this book?
Well, it's really long. I'm excited for editing.
It's like a War and Peace subject matter.
Should we call it a book or an epic?
It's right now, it's 14 chapters. And each chapter is the pitfall and what to do about it. Yep.
Very cool.
Well, much needed.
Yeah. We feel your pain. We're in the middle of writing a book ourselves. As you would imagine, it's on partnerships. But we understand what you're going through. It's a lot.
I would suspect that there are some similarities between where partnerships go wrong and where hiring goes wrong. But, you know, maybe that's a different season. Maybe you bring me back for that. I just keep inviting myself back. So
we'll have you back. So you got to perform today, though. We got to set high standards. So let's jump right into it. Partnership, your ultimate partnership cheat code. Give it to us.
Setting expectations early and often together. Keyword together. So
like it.
Yeah, I have a lot to say on that topic. So that
all
is
right. Let's get going. Setting expectations early and often together.
Always a good idea. Mm-hmm. Rarely executed. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more there.
So give us an example. Yeah.
I think about the power of mutual action plans. You know, so I think about my sales career and I think about the things that I have taken away from that I applied to my business. And I think about it from a partnership perspective. When I hear people describe partnerships or when it's going well or when it's not going well or where it falls short, it's a mismatch of expectations. So what I expected fell short somewhere along the way or vice versa. And then you have that messy middle of misalignment. And so the reason why I'm bringing up a mutual action plan, and I think it's a really good idea, for a lack of a better term, I find it to be an ever-changing, evolving, iterative agenda that we both co-sign, that we both have skin in the game, that we both understand what the little different bits and pieces are. And I find that we get wide-eyed and real excited at the thought of, well, wait a second, I can turn this partnership on. I can set it and forget it. And it's going to bring in all of this money to me. And that's going to be so good. And that's how we're going to grow. And we're going to do it fast. And somebody else can do the selling for my business. And this is just going to be rainbows and roses and unicorns and exits and all the fun things. And then it falls flat. Where are all my partnership leads at? What do you mean that team isn't talking about us? What are you talking about? And I think a lot of it happens in a lot of aspects of business, but specific to this for partnerships, we get excited, happy ears and eyes. So you're telling me about the possibility of something. We're talking about what this could be like. And while that's all exciting, I find that most miss all the stuff that it takes in the middle. So like, here's the outcome. Here's the initial conversation. and we get really excited about the vision of the outcome, that we miss all of the things in the middle, or not all of the things, many of the things in the middle that it takes to get to that outcome. So here's the thing about this. If I don't know what to expect, if I don't know what my role is, if I don't know what my dependencies are to make this thing come to life, and if I don't know yours, who the people are, what's involved, do we have to make tweaks? So whatever organizations, tweaks, integration considerations, like these are things that aren't just between you and I if we're doing the deal together. What about my security team? What about my tech team? What about my product team? What about my eng team? What about, you know, like whoever it is, whatever it is, I find that it's not just one person or one department. It's a multi-pronged approach. So that's my initial coming in real hot take about this whole topic of setting expectations early and often. What do you, Phyllis, think?
Well, I think expectations is a super powerful word because I don't know that everybody is honest about what they are. So you painted the picture of rainbows and unicorns, right? And I think that's what people think about with partnerships, right? So how do you even know if people are coming in and truly laying out what their expectations are?
Well, I think even beyond that, right? Like, how do you make those expectations realistic? Because to your point earlier, like the expectation is always going to be great leads, revenue, you know what I mean? Like everyone aims at the end goal, but I think the challenge that most people run into here is, you know, they haven't seen this process done successfully. And therefore, like it becomes really attractive just to say like, yeah, we're all aiming for the same thing. Like we're aiming for revenue. There's a lot of gradients to your point, like in between there. And so like, how do you show them what good looks like? Like we use that term all the time. Like that context just often isn't there.
Well, I think before you can show anybody anything, you have to understand two things. And I bring this up a lot when I do business with people. One, what's important to you? What are you trying to get out of this? What's in it for you? Why is this appealing? Why is this appetizing? So I think it's just like, what about this is important to you? And then okay. I'm actually listening. So I like to take notes when I'm talking, and you'll see that I'm doing this over here. Because sometimes the stories that we tell ourselves after the fact, especially when we're excited, we miss some of those things. And so I need to reflect back on, well, this is actually important to them. This is why they want to do it. This is why it's appetizing. Does that map back to anything in my world, right? Because if what they're prioritizing is something that I could give two rips about or I can't actually do, that is the first signal. So I look for signals. That is the first signal to pause. So I'm actually hearing that this thing here is really important to you. Is that your number one priority? And they're going to say yes or no, or they're going to say, you know what? Yeah, but there are actually two other things. And for that thing to happen, I need these two things over here to click in. Well, what if I'm really strong with those two other things and those two things could potentially solve for this thing, right? It's that stop, pause, listen, write it down, replay the tape. And it's that slowing it down to temper the emotions, the excitement, the possibility of the vision of the successful thing. So that's the first question. What's important? The second question is, here's what it takes. Not even a question, a follow-up. Here's what it takes. Here are considerations. And then the question for them is, what are yours? And my consideration could be, I hear you loud and clear. And I think we might be able to do that. I actually have to check on a couple of things, but this is what it looks like in a rough sketch. So it's not just a set it and forget it thing for us. I have to start including my security officer. I need to start thinking about my engineering team because that requires an integration. I need to think about where we are in our roadmap because we haven't done this for anybody. Now, notice what I did. I was really open about it because here's the thing. If you've never done it before and you lie to them and then it takes a long time and you oversell it, you're going to lose the partnership anyway. So I'm all about, that's what I mean by setting those expectations early and often. People I find don't expect us to be perfect. They just want us to be open and honest so that we can figure this out. So when it's like, hey, here's what I'm hearing from you. And I've got you on your top three priorities. And two of those, without a doubt, we've done this multiple times and we can talk about that. But the one thing, I think we need to flirt with that a little bit more to make sure that that actually clicks in. Here's what it takes on my side. Here's who's involved. Here are the considerations when it hasn't gone well in the past. And I do this all the time. When it hasn't gone well in the past, this is why. Mm-hmm. And then I shut my mouth and I watch their body language, because it's not about what they necessarily say to me in turn. It's about how they respond. You're going to see somebody do this and be like, totally. Now I'm glad that we're speaking the same language, or if they're like this, or if I lose them, or if all of a sudden the Slack messages start going and you stopped listening to me. So I lost you. So I need to take note of that and go back to that. That's what I mean by setting those expectations often early. And how does it actually look? It's not just what we say, it's also what we do, but it's how we're responding in the moment.
Yeah, I think, you know, like, because you're in a talent space, my mind just naturally goes into what we've seen as just this recurring theme across all these conversations, which is like how critical the skill set of, you know, this partner, leader, whatever, you know, title we've given them, how critical that skill set is. Like there's entrepreneurship in there. There's the self-awareness. There's, you know, the experience side of things. But like the ability to form relationships is just not a trait that everyone has, right? And so like, I guess, you know, that just seems to be such a recurring theme here in terms of like, you've got to find the right person to head this process up so that they can have those conversations. What are some of those traits that you think about in addition to kind of what you shared already that folks should be identifying in a potential partnership leader?
So I think it's clarifying what the role means. It's kind of like when somebody says to me, I want sales ops or rev ops. And the way that they describe it, there's 50 shades of gray in that thing. Mm-hmm. There also is 50 shades of gray in this thing. And so keep in mind, it's kind of like when customer success came on the scene. And it was this word that people use. And they're like, I need 10 years of customer success. And it had just come out. It's like, well, no, what is it that you actually need? So in my mind, and the work that we do, Justin, to answer your question is, what is the work that's required to do this well? Because we have channel, we have biz dev, we have partnerships, we have OEM, there are lots of different considerations there. And some of those are really nuanced, really nuanced. Sure. And the bigger you go in terms of who you're trying to partner with and what that actually looks like, the more complex it gets. And not every channel person, partnership, biz dev person even knows how to do that. And so I think it starts with, let's define what the role actually is. What is the work that's required to do this well? What are the gaps in our business by not having this role? If we're delighted by this person in a year from now, what have they actually accomplished? Oh, and then let me temper my expectations, my own expectation early and often. How am I even validating that this is true? Am I just pulling something out of thin air because this is what I want because I read this article and somebody else did it, or some yahoo on LinkedIn is being like, I am the partnerships extraordinaire? No, what is actually real for me? Because our perception isn't necessarily our reality. And so it starts with that, and then it bleeds out from, well, what do we call it? And what does it actually look like? And what is the hiring profile for this? Like all this stuff compounds, but it starts there first.
So you kind of, I like what I'll call your clarity framework, right? Like really extracting clarity from people. It's obvious that you've worked with a lot of founders because by repeating things back to them that they said, they're almost like, wait, I said that? I mean, founders, they oftentimes don't know what direction they're going and what they even said. So I absolutely love that. So we know this, founders sometimes, especially if they're technical founders or product-based founders, struggle with sales, struggle with marketing. They don't know what it is. They don't know how to track it. Don't know how to measure it. Don't know the personalities. Now, partnerships is this whole other thing. How do you even get a founder to wrap their head around all that stuff you just said? Because there's 10 different types of partner leaders. There's, like you said, OEMs, channel, blah, 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 blah. How do you even get a founder centered on what partnerships looks like?
So I like to do an audit of their current state of the union. So I'm of the mindset, and there are always exceptions to the rule. So I'm not going to speak in an absolute statement, but I am of the mindset that generally speaking, partnerships comes later. It's not where you start when you're early days. So I deal with
founders that
are, I'm going to quantify it, but I think this next statement helps me do that. So I deal with founders that are anywhere between $1 million to $25 million. If you're between the early, like one to let's call it 10, that's not necessarily the time to be introducing partnerships. Why? Well, if you don't have product market fit, I don't care if you want to white label the mess out of it, nobody else will be able to do that for you. And that is one of the biggest misses in all of the things that I think about, that I hear about, that I do, and the work that I do for the hiring that we do when we say no to customers, because no amount of sales talent, channel or otherwise, is going to solve what's fundamentally broken if your product isn't something that the market responds to, wants, needs, et cetera. And so in my mind, I do that audit to understand, before we even think about partnerships, what's happening on the sales team. Well, I don't even really have a sales team. I just want to like partner this out. No, that doesn't work nine and a half times out of 10. And so that's where it's coming from, Justin. I hope I answered your question, but it's like, I think about the house building analogy, which I am in right now. I can't even think about landscaping until it comes to the house actually being done. And before the house is actually done, right now, we're dealing with all sorts of things because I'm on wetlands and I have to deal with lots of different moving pieces. I haven't even poured my foundation yet. And I can't do that until I make sure that the ground is actually stable to do that. If I just go and pour some foundation and the ground isn't stable and I have water and I have a sloping gradient and those things don't, they look good now. I could do it now. It's been a mild winter. And then 2 years from now, I have a cracked foundation. I have water all over the place. I have a mold problem now. It comes back tenfold. It's really expensive. And what I know is this. So in the partnerships that I've done, and I will never forget this, there was when I worked at Yahoo, a lot of the business came from partnerships. I was focused on the direct side, enterprise sales. It would get so messy because we would be talking to the same customer. And let me remind everybody, nobody tells my story better than me. Nobody should know my business better than I do. And if I am dealing with a channel partner that represents 50 other options, and they're being strategic about their relationships and when they bring stuff, and I could be the soup du jour. I could be really the thing that helps. And if all of a sudden all those things are clouded and your interpretation, I heard this a long time ago in my career. I can't tell you who the source is, but it has stuck with me for all these years. Out of 100% of what we share with people, you're lucky if they take away 5. Mm-hmm. So now if all of a sudden I've got it in a channel or OEM or partnership, whatever you want to call it, third party representing me, and they represent a lot of other people. And oh, by the way, the person that I did the deal with isn't out in the field. It's part of their field team. And that person is brand new and they've had 2 seconds of training. Am I really comfortable with how my solution is being represented? Messy middle, right? So that's where this comes from, where it's, if your foundation isn't rock solid, the first sign of a storm, you're going to have the house topple over. So
yeah, I think about that, you know, in terms of maturity more than I do revenue. But like that to your point, it's, and we see this a lot with resale or white label, like, oh, this partner operates under that model. And so we're just going to put together pricing for them because that's how they want to go to market. But, you know, the enablement side of that is, you know, where those programs either live or die. And if you don't, you know, again, to your point, if you don't have that narrative, that process, that maturity in-house and feel really comfortable with it, someone outside those four walls is certainly not going to bring it. I always think back to a really large example of this where people are like chasing logos. You know, this just happened to be like one of the you know, largest marketing automation providers, and they partner with LinkedIn. And it was this, you know, at their show, it was like, you know, their platinum sponsor, big booth, they're rolling out this massive partnership. But no one knows what they're actually selling, right? Like LinkedIn, setting expectations, like LinkedIn wants to move ads, right? Like they want ad spend. This particular platform had no integration to ads. And so like the natural connectivity, like was just missing one another. Like it was very clear the goal was logo, right? Like, oh, look at us. We've really crossed that next chasm and look at the types of organizations that we're partnering with and that are on our website. But things died pretty quickly, and that partnership did die because there not only wasn't that maturity in house, but like from a product standpoint, things just were not aligned. So I think that's just a great example of those expectations being completely, you know, strangers in the night.
Well, and I agree wholeheartedly where it's exciting about the possibility, but as fast as I got that new logo, and I think the market correction that we're seeing in tech is a really good reminder of this. As fast as I chase that new logo, if I don't have the infrastructure, proper expectations, alignment, and actual support and enablement to turn the thing on and deliver, then as fast as I got that is like, it goes dangling right in the, like, bye-bye. I might as well take money and throw it out of my car window driving down the highway, because that's what happens. And so I think it goes back foundationally to what we're hearing and tempering our excitement to actually validate, to quantify and to qualify and to understand that what I'm hearing isn't through rose-colored lenses. Because I do this all the time where it's like I'll replay the tape and it's like, actually, no. I like partially, yes, and no, this thing over here, actually, that's not what I'm saying. Thank God I asked.
Yeah.
So where have you seen this, you know, like great from a strategic standpoint, but like when the rubber meets the road, like where have you seen this like really perform? Like what's kind of your top, you know, success story having involved this, this fundamental?
You're not going to like this. I haven't seen it go very well anywhere.
Wow.
Really? Nowhere.
Anywhere I've worked. Here's why. Yeah. You can bring in revenue. And I find that people really look at that marker, but where is the revenue coming from? How long does that revenue last? What does it take to get that revenue? And here's where I've seen it not work very well. In the middle between teams. So if you have a sales team that also represents the exact same product in the exact same territory, oh, and now you have this channel team doing the thing, turning it on, it's white labeled. These two teams, they don't know each other. They don't talk to each other, and they may not even know that the deal went on. And so now guess who suffers for that? Your customer.
The customer,
right. Yeah.
And it's not just even the customer, it's also the team. And I have had this angst myself. I've seen this firsthand. I've had plenty of conversations about this. It's also your team because it affects how they make money. So let's say now all of a sudden it's been a good year. And what do we always do with our teams? We increase their quota. And now if I've got somebody in my own backyard and creating friction and not necessarily even projecting some of the same information that the buyer should know, now the buyer is suffering. They're confused. There are no rules of engagement between these teams. And you've got two other teams. You've got the channel, turner honor, whatever, your customer, that's your channel partner. And you have the channel team. They did a really good deal. They're celebrating. That looks like success. And they're just counting the dollars. But what about the other teams? What about right. their ability to reach their goals and revenue? That's why I've never seen that go well.
Well, it's interesting. Like we do run into that quite a bit in, you know, early partner teams where they're driving a lot of net new revenue through partners. And, you know, the double check there is, you know, like great, you know, you've established a very effective cost of sale. But customer success is sometimes a really a struggle in that situation because they don't have a really solid relationship with, you know, the actual provider. They view, you know, that solution as an add-on or something that you know, is a widget that kind of plugs in to that partner solution, because they're doing the majority of the sale. They're driving that lead. It feels great just to kind of stroke the contract at the end of the day. But the CS team is often having to resell that customer relationship and just show them, who are we? Where do we fit actually within this puzzle? So it's an interesting kind of dichotomy there when you're seeing a lot of revenues come in, but you know, a lot of the core fundamentals that you would have handled through a direct sale have not been broached with those customer organizations. And as a result, you know, churn can be an issue. The relationship is certainly an issue. So you've got to, again, you've really got to think through those potential pitfalls and address those with kind of these early expectation settings. So even when we get that lead, how are we then going to indoctrinate that customer? And even knowing that we're going to have to put more effort and time and money and so on into that process is I think something that just comes with that experience.
Well, and I think how you do one thing is how you do everything. And so when I think about really successful sales teams or go-to-market teams, they're integrated. There are rules of engagement. Everyone's very clear. And when a deal is being done, that's when that post-sale team, whether it's account management, whether it's customer success, whether it's implementation, whether it's the whole kit and caboodle, they're already being introduced before the ink is dry. So it's a seamless transition. It's not this choppy, like, oh, wait, now I've got to resell. These people don't even know me. They're not even returning my call. I don't even know how to provide value. I don't know what the expectations are. And so I think that has a lot to do with it. And when I see success, it's when everyone understands what their role is. They are incentivized the right way to realize the behaviors and actions and outcomes we want to see across the board, not just one team versus the other team. And, you know, the simple truth is, especially with the bigger partnerships, the party is just getting started when it turns on. What about all the cross-sell, upsell revenue? And there's so much opportunity that gets left behind on the cutting room floor when we don't stop to think about what those considerations are, who's involved, where does the sales team get involved? And then I find it's the same thing that happens with our marketing folks. You start doing this and it's a blame game and it's us versus them. And again, who's suffering for it? Well, our bottom line is, and we don't even realize it, but also we have major friction and the customer sees that. And it's interesting, Grammarly did a study last year with the Harris Poll about the cost of poor communication. This is going to reinforce why I'm dying on this hill of having these kinds of conversations. Yes, it's a hard conversation up front. Yes, you're challenging people. Yes, you're trying to figure it out, but it'll be a lot harder later. So it's like, choose your hard. But here's the stat that blew my mind. How much do I'm going to play a little game here. I want to play the guessing game.
Let's do it.
How much do you think in the U.S. alone, just the U.S., I don't have any global data. How much do you think is spent every year on poor communication?
Is this Price is Right rules? I think it should be like the closest without going over. Yes. Poor communication, U.S. wide on an annual basis. Josh, set the benchmark.
$40 billion.
Oh, wow. That's higher than it's going to go. I'll do the $1.
What?
The Price is Right strategy. I think Josh is too high.
No, Josh is too low. It's $1.2
trillion. Wow. Oh, crazy.
There we go.
And to
see in the showcase showdown, drive, Josh.
to drive it home even further, and it's true. When you think about it, on average, every person every week, and I actually think this is conservative, spends at least 8 hours of their time that could be spent on many other productive things cleaning up after poor communication.
Mm-hmm. I'll buy that.
Yeah, I buy that for sure.
So think about all the money, all the time. And by the way, not every deal is a good deal, right? And I think that's the thing that happens in some of these dynamics is we just chase. And when I find that I've ever chased something, it hasn't stuck. And here's the other thing. If you have friction and all this misalignment and miscommunication and a lack of rules of engagement, the thing is, then trust is broken. And if it could have really been an amazing opportunity for everybody involved and just required a little bit of oil and grease and TLC up front, that's cool. But here's the thing. Once trust is broken with our customers or our channel partners or anybody else for that matter, it's real hard to get that back. And here's what I do know for a fact. You start doing this, and let's say you're doing these deals to get into to enterprise. And let's say you get into, I don't know, I'm just thinking about one of my old customers that would be, that told me about their experiences with this stuff. And then I would use it of what not to do, which is great. That's right. That's a tip. Talk to your customers and then do what they tell you to do of what they like and what they don't like. Right. But I'm thinking about this one particular customer, and they were a huge global in the Detroit area automotive company. I'll let you figure out which one it is. And the thing that happens is when things start going south, they don't always tell you. They just start going quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, and I will never forget because it helped me get even more money because I was there. I wasn't going away. I was delivering. We were doing great business. It was helping them. It was doing all the things that we wanted to do. And this other thing fell flat. And then I remember the buying committee telling me how much this company regretted what they had done, and they kept trying to get back in. And once the door shuts, it is almost impossible to get it open again unless those people leave.
Right.
And so these are things like, it's like the long game. It's not just what I want here and now that's going to pad my wallet. It's also what happens in the short term and what happens in the long term. And what are the consequences if this thing goes wrong? So, yeah, that's why.
Yeah, I think it's just such an interesting reminder. Like I think companies under index on training and just employee enablement in general. But like when we do invest in those areas, it's never, soft skills like communication. Just like, how do we make, the act of convincing someone else that, what you need them to do is in their best interest? How do you communicate that effectively? How do you, set those outcome expectations? What are going to be the indicators of success along the way and so on? Like, those are just areas that like we leave people to figure out. And I always think back to like internship programs that we've run where like you literally have to teach someone how to send business email, right? Like early folks who were early in their career. But then you think about like, if you're teaching fundamentals like that, God, the communication aspect of it has to be even in a more abysmal state, especially when you think about kind of like the digital native and the different generations in the workforce. Like, just such a great reminder that the amount of money that's being lost in partnership programs and frankly across the board as it relates to communication and the effectiveness of that is massive. I can't believe that number. That's crazy.
If I were leading a big team again, the very first thing that I would do for any hire I would make is invest in communication. And here's why. Look at what happened over the last like 10, 15 years. You didn't have to be that good to have good returns. And we're seeing those effects now. There are plenty of people that are like, I'm a CRO. No, you're not. You are a glorified BDR manager that kept getting promoted, that if you wanted to hire me, then you'd have to give me a bigger title. You're a one trick pony. You only know one thing. And that thing is inbound only. Well, guess what? That's not working.
It's not really working anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
That's not a deal. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right.
And if all you did was succeed through inbound and the business succeeded in spite of itself, which we saw a lot of that. And you don't know how to communicate. You don't have executive presence. You don't know how to have a hard conversation. You talk about how you're a great coach and you rely on Gong to do that. That's not coaching. right? And so these are things that this is fueling my business, that what got me here with that leader that was so hard to get, that looked like an A player in the market that we came out of, is actually a C minus player.
Right.
And I'm not getting what I need. And I need somebody that's multidimensional, not one dimensional. And so if you weren't taught, whether it's how you grew up in a digital situation or you just were thrown into this and you had some good stats and you kept going on. Oh, and by the way, the founders or the leaders that you might be working with, they weren't trained to communicate well. Everybody can be well-intended. They can be really smart. I'm not judging these people like they're horrible people. They just haven't learned and they may not know any better. And I find then that it's this pattern of, well, what's the matter? What do I do? Well, what's not working? The ability to connect with another person.
Right.
That's how you also bot-proof yourself. So, you know, the bots are here. They're not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere, excuse me. And they're only going to get smarter and better. And if we don't keep up with that as humans, with the things that we can control,
yeah, it's not a great career. The things that are unique, to your point, right? Like the ability to connect, form relationships, just more, even more critical today than ever before, which is, you know, an interesting impact to your point on AI and everything else that everyone's so hyped up about.
Yeah. I mean, think about AI for channel. We'll just write some code and have it be in blah. And that's going to go great. And it's like, well, now who's setting the inputs? Because those inputs,
if your value as a partner leader was just, you know, recording deals
dots,
that have been, you know, sent across the line and trying to track where those are at from an opportunity standpoint and the amount of bookings that have been driven, like those are pretty simple tactics that can be replicated, you know, in systems. And we're already seeing that. It's the folks that are truly unique that went in there and found, you know, what is the 1+1=10 around this relationship? What can we solve for you? What can we solve for your customer? What can we solve for your AEs, your CS folks, so on and so forth down the line? And really, you know, brought that pragmatic mentality. Like those are the folks that you want to identify to run one of these programs, not just someone that's worked at, you know, a big logo or what was the sexiest company. But to your point, right, like we just had that conversation the other day, like you look at most great marketers who are kind of, you know, kind of held up on that pedestal. They also worked at like massively disruptive technologies, right? Like I don't want, you know, the marketer at Slack per se, like the product is, you know, just a wildfire and, you know, was when it came to market. Like I want the individual that really had to like find those value props, understand the buyer and do the things that, you know, just a lot of folks have not had to do in their career.
My question is always to figure that. How'd you do it?
How do you find that? How'd you go about doing it? Yep.
What was your role specifically? When you came in, what did it look like? When you were there, what did you do? And when you left, and I find that most people that are like ex Uber, ex Slack, ex LinkedIn, ex Twitter, ex whatever, it's like, so what?
Right.
Who? It doesn't matter, because I could hire you. This is a pitfall for hiring. The shiny object syndrome, it is alive and well. I'm a former shinyaholic. I've made these mistakes, right?
Shiny-aholic.
Where you get seduced by the what if. Yeah, shinyaholic, it's a real thing. It's a real syndrome. It's running rampant. But, you know, all fun aside, I think especially if you don't know, if you haven't done this before, if you're excited about what the possibility is, then talking to somebody that sounds really good, and it doesn't take a lot to sound really good these days. You know, I can go to a community, I can go online, I can copy and paste, I can run a prompt through AI that could be really smart, that gets me really prepared for that conversation. But if I haven't truly done it and I've duped you, we're going to find out later anyway. And so it is that taking a little bit of extra time and really digging below of quantify and qualify. Help me understand, what does that look like specifically? I'm still confused. Tell me about that. Because I think people start talking about, well, we as a team did this. Okay. And for years we were taught, You're not good unless you're a team player, right? So everyone has the we. Great. I don't think that you're not a team player. Let's drop the we. What did you actually do?
Yeah. Why do you think people are so uncomfortable just really focusing on what they're good at and their strengths and trying to, instead of like trying to overcome it with this other stuff that maybe not even be in their wheelhouse, but talk about it with no real foundation?
So is your question, why do I think people are projecting, or your question is something else? Like there are a few things that I could go down that path, and I don't want to misinterpret what you're trying to dig into here.
I think like you're talking about people interviewing and lying essentially, right? And saying, you know, saying all these things that they're good at and they're not really, when why not just take a deep dive on the one thing you are really good at, right? Like there could be all these things to your point earlier about gaining clarity, right? You said there's three things, right? And I'm really good at these two things. I might not be so good at the third thing. A candidate should kind of be the same thing. Like, listen, I can get real deep on this one thing because that's where I'm really strong. The other two things you talked about, maybe not my sweet spot, but let's talk about this for a little bit and maybe we can get into how do I up level or whatever. I don't know. People seem to be afraid to talk about what they're not good at.
Shortcomings.
Well, I think that there's fear that if I'm honest with you, you'll take it away from me.
Sure.
And I think the other thing is, if you grew up in the last 10 years in tech specifically, if you grew up in this landscape and you achieved greatness without having to be that great,
right,
your ego has not caught up to reality yet. And so I think there's that. I also think that there's social media is a blessing and a beautiful thing and an ugly curse. And you have a lot of group think about like, oh, well, you know what? You shouldn't have to work that hard. You shouldn't have to do that. You shouldn't. And it's like, yeah, I shouldn't. And right, it's kind of like, you know, excellence always creates opportunity. And the only way to get excellent is actually to like do it and learn.
Do stuff.
And part of excellence comes from knowing yourself and understanding that you're not a perfect being. The work is never done. I'm not perfect. I've had great success in my career. I am always challenging myself to figure out blind spots. And because I have such a strong personality, people are afraid to do that with me. And I'm like, no, I want to hear it when I'm asking you for it. If it's like some drive-by rando, no, thank you. But if it's somebody that's in my circle that I trust and respect and has a different point of view, I don't want groupthink of just yesing me to death. I want to know what I'm missing. Not everybody is like that. And so that's one thing. But the other prong to this is it happens on both sides of the hiring equation. So this is something that has been ingrained in hiring managers, and it is something that has been ingrained in the person interviewing. And it's at every level, all different things. Your job is to sell each other on working together. Just get that offer. Just get that role filled. It's the outcome. I just have the outcome in mind. And then you miss, kind of like what we were talking about before, there's all this stuff in the middle that you miss. And now we're appalled that I feel duped or baited and switched. And it's funny because this just happened recently in the Stage 2 Slack community. Somebody reached out to me and they're like, yeah, you know what? I just started my role. I'm in a couple of weeks and this is a dumpster fire. And this is a leader, by the way. And my first question always is, what do you think you missed in the interview process? Immediate blame. Like, no, I can blame everybody, but hold on. What did you find out? And then when I start really pinpointing, I kind of knew and I ignored it. And so I think there's really horrible advice, and I'm thinking about the person that speaks about this a lot, and I will not name and shame. That's not my jam. But they have a very big pedestal on LinkedIn, and what they project isn't necessarily congruent with what happens behind the scenes. And what's really icky about it is this concept of when you're going through interviews, your job is just to get as many offers as you can get. Just get them. Just get all those offers. Okay, have either one of you interviewed for a job before?
It's been a long time.
Have either one of you anytime recently talked to somebody interviewing for a job or even read anything about it?
Oh, yeah. Yes, for sure.
Okay, it's hard. It requires a lot. And the cherry roles, they do have a high bar. Oh, and by the way, it's really competitive and the bar has already raised even more.
Yeah.
If I am going into that mindset of my job is just to get as much as I can get, how do you think I'm showing up in the interview process?
Right.
How do you think that I can actually make a well-informed decision? The answer is no. And if I'm on the other side of the hiring equation and my job is to just get this butt in the seat filled, or, and I hate this advice. I absolutely hate it. Hate is a strong word. I hate this advice. Your job as a hiring manager is to sell the person. No, it's not. Your job is to achieve alignment, because when you're aligned, you don't have to sell anything in sales, in partnerships, in hiring, in marketing, in customer success, in product, in everything. It's kind of like even in our personal lives. If I'm aligned with someone, dating, friendship, my husband, we've been married, it'll be 19 years in June. We're aligned. Doesn't mean we always like each other or agree, but we are aligned.
Correct.
So I believe this deeply in my soul, that when you know what you stand for and you know what's important to you and you know what your warts are and what you're really good at and what you're excellent at and what you could do, but you don't want to do, and you bring that to the table in anything, hiring or otherwise, that's where you can really achieve alignment.
Yeah.
That's great. Well,
I think it's a really good place to wrap up and kind of get a little bit more info, because you mic dropped it, right? I like it. So tell us a little bit about, tell the audience where they can find you, a little bit about Avenue Talent Partners and what you're bringing. Obviously, you know, alignment and clarity and being connected and clicked in, but in your words.
Yeah. So you can find me on LinkedIn. I think I'm the only Amy Volus, unless some sort of bot tried to take me over. But I'm there, avenuetalentpartners.com. And we focus on helping startup founders make really confident, great hiring decisions to avoid the turnover odds. And that's at the VP plus level for sales and CS. So between avenuetalentpartners.com, LinkedIn, and this book that I'm writing, it'll be very, very clear of how you can find me. I don't hide. So I love nerding out on stuff like this. I say my hotline is always on. It really is. And this stuff is hard. And so I appreciate the conversation. This is an important one to have. And thanks, fellas. I hope that this is useful for anybody that took the time to hear us.
Yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate you joining the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. For those listening, please visit inrevenuecapital.com, the cheat code. Give us a like, give us a follow, all of those good things. Make sure you find Amy and listen to the next episode coming out. I mean, I think we'll have you live within a week or so. So it's good to have everybody here, and thanks for joining the cheat code.
Yay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Amy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Growth requires more than capital.
Why do we call it the cheat code? Nobody said growth had to be fair.
Revenue solves everything.
Welcome to the cheat code.
What was our fastest path to revenue?
We tend to like to do things the hard way.
What's the cheat code? It's giving yourself an unfair advantage over the others.
What is it that really works, and how are we going to grow these organizations?
That's our cheat code.